You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that the first Anzac Day to be commemorated was in 1942 at the Australian War Memorial? It wasn't a very large gathering. They were prohibited at the time in case of a Japanese air attack. Since then, the marches and services have grown, not least of all because we've been involved in more wars, conflicts and peacekeeping activities. There are some people who never agree with a war, and none of us like the consequences. But sometimes it seems as if it's almost inevitable. It was in 1914. So how did people react then? And how does that differ from how they react now? In 1981, the World Bank came up with the term emerging markets. What that means is that they're moving from a closed economy to an open market economy while building accountability within the system. This isn't a simple process, and sometimes that one tiny bit of bad economic news can send markets tumbling, and usually if one goes down, many go down. So why is this so? Why are these markets so volatile? And why does it seem that they lurch from one crisis to another? We'll find out a bit later, but right now let's talk to Counterpoint regular David Birchall. Well, David Birchall, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Amanda.
Now, look, we've had over 6 months of the Abbott government, and I thought it might be time to pick your brains or give you the opportunity to vent on your view of the first 6 months.
Yes, well, people have been venting. Of course, I think one of the problems is that people have been venting usually from very familiar positions. I guess what struck me most about the last 6 months is, and this is true of all new governments to some extent, but I think more than you would have expected, that the new government is very preoccupied by its predecessors. Partly rhetorically preoccupied, I think, to paint the previous government as inept and self-obsessed, but also I think genuinely preoccupied. They have a sense that the previous government failed and that they are not going to make the same mistakes. I think probably the question moving past the first 6 months of this government is going to be to what extent they can constructively use those insights into their predecessors' failings and to what extent it simply weighs them down, to what extent they spend their first term simply being the anti-Rudd-Gillard government. I think there's certain hints at the moment of an understandable and even legitimate preoccupation with their predecessors' failings starting to become a little bit obsessional at times.
Well, that reminds me of a saying that a former senator said to me once. This person lost their seat, actually, because they were so obsessed with settling scores.
Right. He said to me... It's one of the lovely things of being a new government, isn't it?
Well, he said to me, don't get angry, get even, when I was angry about something, because politics can make you angry, people in it make you angry. True of the rest of life as well, I know, but I think more so in politics. And then I read a book called Hardball, which Laurie Oakes had recommended to a colleague of mine, and said it was as good as Machiavelli's The Prince.
How many times has that recommendation been said of a political book, yes?
Well, Hardball's really good. Now, it has a chapter that says, don't get angry, don't get even, get ahead. Nothing annoys your colleagues more. Is that advice that you'd offer?
There is nothing more self-destructive, in a way, is there, than focusing on getting back at your opponents?
That's true. It is important, however, to learn lessons.
Yes, that's right.
But if you let someone who's annoyed you, let's not put it in a Liberal Labour sense,
it's a life message.
If you let someone so get under your skin and so aggravate you that you, for example, going down the street to buy an ice cream and you cross the street because you see one of them, you want to go and fix them up, well, you've forgotten the purpose of your outing, which was to go and buy yourself an ice cream.
Yeah, no, I think it's...
They've detracted you and distracted you from your main path. Now, you think that's a risk for the Abbott government, do you?
Well, I think on two grounds. For instance, the Royal Commission into the Home Insulation Scheme. You can read it either of two ways. You could read it as a legitimate exercise in settling and sorting out a mess created by your predecessors, or you could read it as score settling. I think in practice it's been both of those things, and I think it actually is a very useful exercise. The danger is that you can then read into what comes out of it the wrong things and get, again, preoccupied by your predecessors. And I think And the funny thing about Kevin Rudd is, curious figure though he was in Australian politics, he will continue to linger on, partly just as an irritant. I think to his opponents, he was so annoying because they believed him to be so fraudulent, a political character, that this tendency, I think, to want to be kind of the anti-Rudds. And that falls back into your characterisation, I think, of being too preoccupied by the people who annoy
you. That's not a Liberal Labor comment either, because the anti-Rudd people, some of them, the most vociferous, were among the Labor Party.
Well, that's true, yeah. In their minds, Rudd had brought down a well-functioning government. Whether or not that's true is another question. So, yes, they were very personally focused on Rudd's misdemeanours and even, as they saw it, craziness. But, yes, it's infected their opponents too, I think, an excessive obsession.
For what it's worth, I've looked at some of the coverage of the Home Insulation Inquiry and think it a very instructive piece of work for any public servant who looked at that must now think, when they're asked to do something and asked to rush it, asked to bypass something, because that's what the government wants, would at least have now, I think, the good sense to send a document saying, my advice is, this needs to be done. Please don't misunderstand me. I don't say that to blame public servants for what happened.
And they've been frantically defending themselves in retrospect in the commission.
Yeah, well, they have. But, you know, they say they give free and frank advice. And so one might say, well, let's see if we can find the emails that say, you know, you must do this, you must do that.
And everyone who ever wrote such an email has managed to unearth it and dump it on the commission by now.
probably have. But it's a good lesson for both sides, both for public servants and for parliamentarians.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who feel pressured by the public to get something done. Let's just get something done. You've heard the saying, don't let the perfect stand in the way of a damn good job. You know, let's just get it done.
Mm.
There is that pressure on people in government.
Yeah.
And equally, that pressure translates to the public service. So a slow unpicking of what happened there, because lives were lost, I think is very instructive for politicians of all sides and for all public servants everywhere.
I agree. Having read, like you, through some of the transcripts, but not being able to wade through all of them yet, let alone all the extra documentation, the endless emails and letters, what does seem obvious is that overconfidence and a lack of realism and a lack of understanding about what governance is and the limits on it and the complexities of it is one of the most striking failures of that period of that government. And clearly Rudd set that off by not only empowering but requiring people to act far too fast and misunderstanding the context too. We need to spend as much money as humanly possible as quickly as possible or else we'll fall into depression, which is clearly, in hindsight, a ridiculous overestimation of our economic situation or underestimation of it. But yes, that sense that all the normal prudence and sense of constraint, all those sort of traditional Burkean concerns about perverse consequences of actions taken too quickly and a failure to understand how well-intentioned objectives always produce things that you don't intend them to, and therefore there is a logic to taking things one step at a time and seeing what works and what doesn't. All of those things that one thought Labor had learnt in its previous period in government, when it seemed to exhibit most of those traditional restraints, just seemed to go out the window in 2008, 2009.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't take much for either ministers to stand up to the Prime Minister or to more senior ministers.
Well, it seemed to at that time for some reason.
or for public servants. I mean, I can think of three occasions, none of which I want to go into detail about. One where I said to a senior colleague who was wanting something to happen a particular way when I was a junior minister, that's fine, you're the senior minister, all you have to do is give me an email to that effect, because I disagree, I think you're wrong, and I need a record of that, and that sort of changed that situation. And two other occasions with the Prime Minister's office where staffers do this, they often ring up and say, well, the Prime Minister wants, well, that's fine. Given what I've just said to you, you give me an email saying you understand what I've said, and that's what the Prime Minister wants in response, and he can have it, because the email never came.
Yeah. Just to add to that point, from my readings of the transcripts of the Royal Commission, one thing that obviously went wrong at that time was, partly because of the imperial style of rule that Prime Minister Rudd had at that time.
The failure of cabinet processes.
Yeah, there is no sense of process or responsibility in a lot of these documents. I mean, it's not clear what Peter Garrett was actually responsible for. And you've got shadowy figures like Mark Abib, well, he's not really shadowy, is he? bouncing around the landscape, making decisions apparently across purposes. It must have been very unclear to public servants who was giving them instructions and with what authority and where responsibility in the end lay. And I think that clearly is another one of the lessons, which points back to exactly your point. So long as people understand what their responsibilities are, they can act responsibly. When responsibility has been thrust out the window and everything is a series of orders from on high, then things turn imperial and they go bad really fast.
David, I've probably said this to you before, but Dame Margaret Guilfoyle said to me once, Amanda, experience teaches, but responsibility educates. And it's absolutely true. When your name is on the bottom line, when you're signing the piece of paper, and that's why I think for public servants and junior ministers alike, saying to someone, just give me an instruction, give me a written instruction to do that in light of the advice I've given you, and I will, of course, do everything you want because you are in charge. I think nothing works better than that as a break, because what it says to people is, if this all goes pear-shaped and there's a cluster happening, your name is going to be right in the centre of it. And that nothing makes people think twice more than that. Whereas when you have what you're talking about, this sort of imperialistic approach, the leader says this, people tend to think, well, he'll take responsibility.
That's right, yeah.
And history should teach them that actually those people don't.
No.
They run away and say some other schmuck can.
Well, as we can see with Kevin, he never took responsibility for any of the failings, actually. And it always ended up somewhere well down the food chain.
We're getting off the topic.
Back to the current government and not...
Yeah, we're going to have to come back.
We're doing what they're doing. I think we're excessively focusing on their predecessors.
Well, it is an interesting story, but in any event, your clear warning to this government is to focus on the future rather than be seen as a government that's focusing on the past. Now, it might be a bit early to make that as a concrete conclusion, but you're saying that's a risk.
That's definitely a risk. And I think there's an associated risk which goes along with what we've just said as well, which is not simply an obsessive preoccupation with the past and with one's predecessors, but whether you're learning the right lessons, as you said before, from it. I mean, definitely hubris and overconfidence are two of the markers of the early period of the Rudd-Gillard government, and actually followed through a large part of their time, I think. But the danger is, I think, of learning that lesson too well and then presuming that the chief business of governing is to avoid mistakes. And of course,
it's a good idea, though, isn't it, to avoid mistakes?
Well, of course it is a good idea.
It's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
I like it.
The danger is that you can then fall into the opposite trap, I think, of thinking that the business of government is to divest yourself from the need to make decisions. And that can be an equally dangerous snare, it seems to me. I have to say, I think that most of the missteps of the new government have seemed to involve a bit of an overreaction that way.
Are you expecting to be made a knight?
Are you, Amanda?
I'm sorry that
you... Or a dame, I'm sorry, you would be a dame rather than a...
I'm sorry you've revealed you haven't read the article I wrote in The Age on this issue. I wouldn't have done it. I don't think it's appropriate. I think it should have gone through the proper cabinet processes. And if they're going to proceed with it, I had a suggestion which nobody's taken up, so let me take the opportunity of boring you with it. And that is that if a knight has a partner who can be called Lady So-and-so, that should cease and desist, because when someone's made a dame, their partner doesn't get any title. So why not treat men and women the same? But I wouldn't have done it. But look, apart from that, which I do regard as a mistake, what else would you say?
Well, I
done
think
wrong?
One of the things that comes to mind, and I'm not debating the merits or otherwise of the decision, because this is something that's been, as an Adelaide person, you'll know this, this has been coming like a train wreck for a long time, but the seemingly rapid collapse of the automotive industry, I think the government handled badly rhetorically, but possibly even in a policy sense. And I think perhaps, again, reacting too much against the sort of disorganised interventionism of their predecessors, wanted to be seen as too virtuous in this regard and too hands-off. And in the process, I thought, looked almost to be taking glee and enjoyment out of the collapse of what once was a major Australian industry. Now, we all know that the automotive industry was on its last legs. We know that General Motors, to call it by its real name, and Ford were producing cars and had mortgaged themselves to producing cars in Australia that probably don't really have a future, except amongst country people and people in parts of the outer suburbs.
They weren't making cars that people wanted to buy, were they?
Well, it was a market niche that if General Motors and Ford had wanted to market across the world, you know, the large rear-wheel drive family car, it might still have been a survivor, but clearly there was no commitment to do that. And the hybrid Camry you can import cheaper than you can make it here, let's face it, so hey. There clearly was not a future to the automotive industry long-term, but I think that the way they handled it politically, but also in a policy sense, wasn't good. And it seemed almost as if they were saying, we're not going to do what those other people did. We're not going to throw money willy-nilly at industries. We're going to be virtuous to the point of almost mania. I think that sent some curious signals to the public. You don't want to revel in the demise of a once major industry and a lot of skills that are necessarily going to go down the tubes as a result of it. I mean, perhaps inevitably, but you want to mourn it and you want to do it in a dignified way.
Did you mean to say you don't want to be perceived as revelling, even though you're not?
There were ministers who looked as if they were revelling in this because it made it look as if they were hard-nosed and austere and that they weren't going to fall into the sentimental traps of the previous government of celebrating some past manufacturing glory now long gone. I mean, it may or may not be that we don't have a manufacturing future. I suspect it depends what you mean by what kind of manufacturing. There could have been different decisions made by Ford and General Motors about what kind of cars to produce. We could have been trying to be in different niches, for instance. They never even thought those thoughts, it seems. But, yeah, I think it was a bad look, but not just a bad look. It was a sign of a government that perhaps was too concerned to be distancing itself from the policy excesses of its predecessors.
You are a bit of a sorry socks, aren't you? negative, negative, negative. Gee, you're sounding a bit like, let me think, someone in opposition. But nonetheless...
Since you've given me that challenge, I think the first 6 months of this government have been competent on the whole. There have been some good decisions made, some not-so-good decisions, but I would have thought that the most obvious warning signs are an excessive preoccupation with not being the previous government and defining your own virtues against the vices of your predecessors.
David Birchall, it's always a pleasure.
No trouble, Amanda.
David Birchall is a senior lecturer in the School of Humanities and Communication Arts at the University of Western Sydney, and he'll join us again next month to talk about matters of interest in Australia. You're on RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. JP Morgan Assets Management has just announced that right now is the time to invest in emerging markets. It predicts that they will bounce by 10% or more in the coming 12 months. This would be a stunning reversal from recent years when they've lost up to 11%. But what does that mean and why are they all locked into a kind of boom or bust scenario? Emerging markets, that's where the business sector looks and says, money to be made, but of course, risks to be borne. And the question is, why do emerging markets suffer occasionally such big shocks? Joining us to tell us all about that is Eliza Wu from UTS, who's the Associate Professor of Finance. Eliza, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Now, Eliza, what is the usual recipe for cooking up a crisis?
So there's typically a long-running reliance on external financing, which has been used to fuel a domestic credit boom.
And that leads cheap credit, lots of cheap credit.
Exactly, which is what we've been having of late. And that leads to usually an overinvestment problem, and that results in asset prices going up and up, leading to what we know as an asset price bubble. And eventually that bubble gets pricked.
Oh dear. Does that mean you have an overvalued currency?
Typically, yes. So as foreign investors are rushing in to invest in that country, that also pushes up the currency value.
Dear, dear. So not so much to go around when you need to fix things up.
Yes, unfortunately.
Well, that's okay. That's one recipe for cooking up a crisis. But why does it happen that when there's a problem in one country, you know, someone sells off a whole lot of bonds or defaults, news spreads so fast? Why does bad news spread so fast amongst these developing economies and they seem to gang up and go out in sympathy? How does that happen?
Typically, investors in emerging markets tend to be quite sentimental. So they're normally driven by be it psychological biases or chasing of perceived higher yields. And so when things look a bit shaky in emerging markets, they also tend to panic and flee that country as well. So emerging markets can end up with this sudden stop problem where basically all the capital flows going into the country can dry up overnight.
It's a pretty desperate situation, isn't it?
Yes, not a pretty sight when that happens. Mm.
There's a description of sort of the unholy trinity of things that can happen, well, that do happen, that are characterised, that are there when this happens. And the first is the large capital flows. We've sort of spoken about that. But the second is that the shock comes as a surprise to market participants. And the third, that they involve leveraging in relation to common creditors. Now, what got me was the suggestion that it's a surprise to the market participants. Because if you go into a developing country where there are higher yields, you know, shouldn't you sort of expect with a higher yield there's going to be a higher risk?
Financially sophisticated investor would expect that, but that's not every investor, obviously. And as I alluded to earlier, there are a lot of investors that are also driven by sentiment or simply greed or psychological biases. So, yeah, not every investor is as astute as you would be, Amanda. So,
well, I don't know about that. I don't know about that at all. But in any event, you can have different types of crisis, can't you? You can have a banking crisis and a debt crisis and a currency crisis. But apparently, the banking crisis is most likely to come first and trigger the others. Is that correct?
Yes. Current research shows that's typically the sequencing of financial crises. As I said before, you tend to have that build-up in excessive lending within emerging markets. And so the banking system is usually weakened as a result of that. And that then escalates further problems within the economy. And then that leads to the currency devaluations and also the build-up in government debt levels as well, which leads to the banking and debt crisis.
Mm. Well, since the banks are so important in the sense of providing funds, but also in the sense that, you know, if you have a banking crisis, a whole lot of other things can happen. That can produce a situation where governments want to keep sweep with the banks, keep the banks going, whatever happens, set up a system where they become almost, well, not intricately entwined, but, you know, too close a relationship for good health. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and we do see that occurring in emerging markets. Yeah, especially the less developed countries where you've got fairly unstable political environments, the governments do tend to make the most of their time in power and, you know, build up the control in the banking system.
You're on something the federal police want to know about if you think governments want to maximise their time in power. Of course, you're right. You're absolutely right. Of course they do. So what's the way out of this for them? Is there a way out of it?
Yes, in my view, I think international policymakers can work together in encouraging emerging market governments to wean off the banks, issue debt more widely to retail investors internationally and to non-bank financial institutions as well, like insurance companies, for instance. So that way, there's not a heavy concentration of sovereign paper on the banks' balance sheets.
Yeah, get the relationship between the government bonds and the banks weakened. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
But who's going to welcome that? People from outside who are investors, yeah, sure. We want a more stable system in which to invest and take our lovely profits home to do wonderful things with them. But I'm just thinking about the emerging economies. You know, they need money, they want money, their banks are there, willing and able at the moment. So they hop into bed with each other and someone comes along and says, gee, that's not really good for you.
Yes, that's right. Governments do tend to be quite short-sighted. Of course, they know this is going to be...
No, you're shocking me again.
Of course, this is going to be a medium to long-term problem, but while they're in power, you know, it's not their problem to deal with.
No, I suppose that's the case. Does that say that if we had a more literate electorate about government finance, I don't mean down to boring details that I don't want, obviously you do know because you're an associate professor, but I don't. But do we need the voters to be more literate and say, look, you know, they're obviously spending more than they can afford, we'll get rid of them?
Yes, that would be a big plus. But if you're talking emerging markets, then of course the educational levels in those countries is also relatively lower. And so, you know, if we're talking even basic educational levels are lower, then of course the level of financial sophistication is also going to be at a lower level as well. But I agree that international investors, so, you know, of course the smart institutional investors can also play a role. Also banking regulation can play a role as well.
So the, for example, mining companies that might have tremendous investments could put a proposition to a government that they're happy to invest, but there are certain things that need to change in that country for that to happen. Is that the sort of thing you mean? Or do you mean IMF?
Yes, it could work at the corporate level. That would also contribute to weaning off the banks. But I was thinking more of international policymakers, so the likes of the Bank for International Settlements, for instance. Yeah. So currently, under the Basel 2/3 framework that we have, capital is charged for, you know, banks holding risky investments. But there's actually a very low risk weighting for holding sovereign paper. So perhaps some of that regulation can be revisited so that, you know, there's not such a big incentive for banks to be loading up on government debt and investing in sovereign paper.
I think it has to be international institutions that bring this change, because while I like to think that the private sector could make those demands of a government, and they of course could, and there are a number of big private sector firms, international global firms, that want developing countries to go ahead. It's in the company's interest as well. But they suffer the problem that if they get a bit hoity-toity with the government about what the government needs to do, a multinational who wants to mine in that area or build roads or, you know, whatever infrastructure arrangements they're entering into will come in and say, look, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Let me have that contract and I'll do it. So I'm not personally confident that the private sector can play a large role. What do you say to that?
Yes, I agree. There's obviously vested interests in the private sector, but I think, you know, really it's everybody's responsibility to ward off these longer term problems, because even though we're talking about emerging markets, really emerging markets are a big part of the global economy now and will increasingly become a big part of the economy, the global economy. Yeah, it's really important that we minimise these emerging market crises.
It's a leadership role for the governments too, isn't it? It's not as if this is a new thing. We've had emerging markets, you know, from when I was a child, and I'm 61. So this has been going on for decades. The cycle's been repeating itself. Why haven't the leaders learnt? Why haven't they looked at another country and said, I don't want that to happen to us. I think we need to go another way. And what I'm coming to ask you is part of the problem, and we like to have a go at politicians and say they're all so short-sighted and they all want to spend to use the power they've got for the time they're in, and there's obviously an element of truth to that, an element of truth. But isn't it also true that not only in the emerging countries, but in Australia, for example, individual voters can all be a bit selfish, whether it's as a consequence of a lack of education, as we were talking about earlier. You know, there's not a high level of education, so we can't expect the electorate to know, was the line I think you were putting. But, you know, here in Australia, we've fallen prey to people who've listened to governments who said, oh, we can give you everything, it's okay, here, have this, and run up huge debt. So isn't that part of the problem? We as individual people just want.
Yes, that would be an underlying problem. You know, you have to think about, well, what is government debt being used to finance? And usually it's, you know, government expenditure to benefit the people and to keep them happy. Yeah.
Well, there are two distinct things, aren't they? To benefit them is one issue, and keeping them happy is another. So really what I'm trying to get to is, if we say that in emerging markets, the explanation for politicians being able to get away with it, for spending too much, is because they don't have a literate electorate in an economic sense. And that's how they get away with it. And that was the explanation I think you were offering. So I'm coming back with another question now, saying, well, that may be true there, but what is the explanation in countries where people, you know, are economically literate, developed countries that have been developed for a long time, good communication systems, everyone understands what the government's doing, if they want to, understands what the spending is, and they still say, yeah, okay, spend.
So I think until recently, we haven't been aware of, you know, such a major problem with government debt until the European debt crisis came along. And also some recent research by Reinhardt and Rogoff, the famous duo, have shown us that actually when you get to certain threshold levels of debt, then it starts becoming a problem. So for emerging markets, that's about the 60% mark of debt to GDP level, whereas in advanced economies, it's actually higher. So the erroneous number that's been given is the 90% to GDP ratio. But as you can see here, that the levels that are tolerated by people in advanced economies are generally higher. Okay, and if you look at the debt levels that advanced economies are carrying, they are typically, you know, on average higher than the emerging market countries because they can afford to have more debt on their books. So investors are more willing to lend to them.
Why can they afford to have more debt? Because they're considered more reliable?
Yes, more creditworthy, yes. have a greater ability to repay, and also they've got more reputational stakes to think about as well. So, you know, for a less developed country to default is viewed very differently to, you know, the US defaulting, for instance, or Australia defaulting, which, of course, Australians would be very concerned about.
Indeed. Indeed, we would. Well, is there another solution, something else that can be done? Fair enough, we want international agencies, policymakers to get together. And I'm sure they focus on this and I'm sure they're working on it, but we all know the pace of change in multilateral agreements is excruciatingly slow. Is there anything else that could be done, or is this just a problem we're stuck with until we finally get the international community together to put pressure on these countries to realise the risk they're putting themselves at?
No, I think something can be done at the national level, and we're certainly seeing that in India right now, where you know, the central bank, Reserve Bank of India, has come out and actually recommended that the government reduce its holdings of the bank assets within the country. So, yeah, it just takes leadership, but it can be executed at the national as well as the international level.
Well, that's a good example of India. Do you know of any others that have been brave enough to try that on with their government?
China has also been running policies where the government was encouraging the banks to lend excessively. And so, you know, the national regulators there have also come out and, you know, they've tried to slow down that credit boom, if you like.
Well, you see, we all want to have a go at banks, don't we? And we'd love to have a go at national regulators. But you've come up with two examples of where they've actually been acting in the national interest, in the interest of the electors, by giving that advice to their governments. It's a refreshing, well, I say it's a refreshing change. Perhaps it happens all the time. Eliza, you've been very helpful. Thanks very much. I think we can close off on this note. Very grateful that none of us are living in a developing economy. And we've all got the privilege of living in a country with a developed economy that, however bad we might think it is, sometimes is not as bad as it could be. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Amanda.
Eliza Wu is Associate Professor in Finance at the University of Technology in Sydney. You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. Anzac Day marks the anniversary of the first military action fought by Australian and New Zealand forces during the First World War. And while the merits or otherwise of what happened have been argued from the safety of armchairs and lecture halls, what happened at the time? More specifically, what did the artists and intellectuals think, and what did they do? With Anzac Day upon us, I thought it might be a good time to share the first few lines of one of my favourite poems, and it is Rupert Brooke's poem, The Soldier, which commences, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England." A fabulous poem, I think. But many say, well, war shouldn't be glorified. There's an organisation called No Glory, furious about any glory being given to those who participated in wars. And it leads us to a discussion of, well, you know, with the First World War being so much a part of the Australian culture, what does it mean and what should we think about it? So joining me to talk about that is Frank Furedi, sociologist and commentator, to whom we have spoken in the past. Welcome, Frank.
Hi there.
Now, do you think we make a mistake, Frank, the way we talk about the Great War in terms of our own society and what we think today, rather than understanding what was happening in the past?
I think so. I think very often we tend to look upon the past in a very kind of malevolent kind of a way. We always see the problems and we always have decided that those were the bad old days and now we're absolutely perfect. And one of the things that we forget to realize is that the war in 1914 provided an opportunity for a lot of people to display a degree of altruism, a spirit of sacrifice, duty. Many people acted heroically. And for some of them, despite all the terrible things and devastation that was going on, it was an opportunity for them to understand themselves in a different way. And that included not just ordinary people of the farms or people that were working in factories, but also teachers, intellectuals, artists, the kind of people that would never imagine going anywhere near a rifle in the 21st century, were often the very first to get stuck in and try to, in a sense, gain meaning from that experience. And although you and I and others might think that the war was a terrible event and would have been better if it never happened, and we often point the finger at certain politicians or military generals for inciting people to go to battle in very bad circumstances, nevertheless, the people that participated in it, you know, ought to be remembered, ought to be celebrated. And in some instances, there's nothing wrong with glorifying their deeds. They were genuine, real heroes.
Mm. In the UK, I understand one of the lottery funds has given close to £100,000 to the Peace Pledge Union to celebrate the war's 16,000 conscientious objectors. And that might be symptomatic of the sort of things people want to look at in the context of the Great War. And that while we might have various ceremonies in one way or another, there won't be a lot of flag waving. People will be talking, I think you say, about remembering and reflecting. But what they're meant to be remembering and about which or what they're meant to be reflecting is left vague. Why do we do that?
Well, I think the reason for that is because we find it very difficult to imagine how a nation came together and believed in itself and believed in its obligation to fight for their country. I think a kind of sense of patriotism today is a very alien concept. We think that patriotic people are usually idiots who are misguided and haven't got an idea in their head. And we kind of forget that many of the heroes of Western civilization, you know, were patriots who fought for the independence of Italy or who fought for the independence of Ireland or many other nations. We simply see patriots as these chauvinist reactionaries who are manipulating people. And I think it's very sad and unfortunate that as a result of that, we become completely detached from our own past. I mean, there's many things about our past that we need to be critical about, including, you know, what happened in that war. But at the same time, we need to understand that these were events that shaped and made us who we are, our democratic sensibilities, our sensitivity to each other, are quite often the legacy of a war where we learn about each other a little bit more and we learn to say, well, perhaps this is not the way to resolve problems. Wars aren't just simply acts of destruction. Out of wars come often experiences and lessons that makes us who we are. And I think that the bravery of the people that fought in the war need to be remembered. As it happens, I think the bravery of the conscientious objectors should also be celebrated, because I think to object to going to fight in the front...
Not easy.
It wasn't an easy thing to do. So I've got no problems with celebrating their attitude, because they were brave individuals, brave people who quite often provided us with very positive examples.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned a range of intellectuals, poets, historians that were quite enthusiastic about this and in some cases surprised at their own feelings. That at the time, they thought they should be opposed to it, but couldn't help but acknowledge the feelings that they had at the time. Why, for example, do you select the comments of the Austrian novelist and playwright Stefan Zweig, is it?
Yes.
Do you think they really highlight the feeling of many intellectuals at the time?
I think so. I think Stefan Zweig is very interesting. I mean, aside from him being one of my heroes, you know, he became one of the best-known pacifists in the 20th century. And he was a man of peace. He kind of sort of learned some very somber lessons out of the experience of the First World War. But in his own writings, he recalls the moment when it became very clear that the war was going to become imminent. And he talks about how, you know, he's walking the streets and there are all these thousands of people being moved by the experience. And they all feel that something powerful that transcended each individual was overwhelming them, was kind of making them excited and focused on what was going to become a very great event. And he felt almost embarrassed by the fact that he felt at one with the crowd of people on the streets. And I think when you look at the writings of many intellectuals, they quite often point to this very interesting development that for the first time in their lives, they were part of something bigger than themselves. They felt a unity, a kind of a link with other individuals. And you and I might say, well, it's a really bad thing that the only time they could ever feel this kind of comradeship, this empathy with other people was as the war was unfolding. But nevertheless, it was one of those experiences that made people feel that they had to do something, that they had to participate in something. As it turned out, what they participated in wasn't the most constructive experience in the world and had a very destructive consequences to it. But nevertheless, you can understand why they felt the way they did. You don't have to agree with them, but you can understand why it was that they were drawn towards something that they may well reject later on and they may react against later on. It was a very important experience that all people should remember as they reflect on what happened 100 years ago.
Mm. You quote his words where he said, "To be truthful, thank heavens, I suppose, I must acknowledge that there was a majestic, rapturous, and even seductive something in this first outbreak of the people from which one could escape only with difficulty." So there clearly was this feeling that spread through the crowds and into people like him and others that something was up, something they wanted to be a part of. What about other intellectuals? For example, Max Weber and Emil Durkheim, they played reasonably active roles, didn't they?
That's right. I mean, Max Weber, who's called the father of sociology, immediately put on his Army Reserve uniform. I think he was a captain in the Army Reserves, and was gung-ho about supporting the war, as was Emil Durkheim, who's French, who supported the French war drive and played an active role in producing propaganda for the war effort. I mean, throughout the Western world, you know, the kind of people who are totally hostile to military conflict, I mean, sociologists being one of them, were part and parcel of this process, as were novelists and artists, painters. They were often far more interested in the developments of leading to the war than anybody else. And the reason for that is because one of the things that distinguishes intellectuals and artists is that they're continually in the business of searching for meaning, of trying to give everyday experience a meaning. And in 1913, 1914, most of them felt estranged and alienated from their society. And as the war began to break out, they began to realize that maybe there was something that connected them to other people. Maybe there was something that connected them to their communities. And I think it's this quest for meaning that led so many of these otherwise sort of peaceful, non-military individuals to become so active in the early years of the war effort. I mean, the one thing that is said on reflection is that it takes a war for millions of people to gain meaning out of life rather than some other slightly more constructive experience.
Mm. Well, I mean, I was thinking about Max Weber and imagining if Australia went to war and I went to someone's house, especially, for example, an anthropologist, and they opened the door to the dinner party that I was attending, dressed in their reserve uniform, I would be quite frankly shocked. I just wouldn't expect that in Australia today. You'd probably think they'd gone mad. Because war is not a good thing. I mean, I think sometimes war is not so much inevitable as an ugly situation, but the best of bad choices you have in front of you. No one wants to be in that position. So someone who appears to be celebrating it in the sense of, you know, whacking on your uniform when you have people for dinner is, you know, somewhat unusual and not something I think that many of us appreciate, that artists at the time and intellectuals were so much a part of this. Now, some people have said that this was not just a geopolitical war, but a culture war as well, and that's why these people are involved. Do you think that's a fair description?
I think so. I think in many respects, many of our cultural conflicts today, this is what I argue in my book, have their origins in the First World War, because although we think of the First World War as a military one, where people were killed and wounded, and towns were destroyed, it was also a war of ideas, and it was also a war about culture. And if you look at the debates and the discussion, you know, many German intellectuals and artists believed that they were fighting for the German soul, which was not as materialistic, was not as calculating and as instrumental as Anglo-American culture was. And a lot of people in France saw that they were fighting a civilizational war where they were defending the values of the Enlightenment against the German hordes. And similarly, in England, you had a very sort of strong sense of duty to a culture that you were sort of standing up for. So when you look at the war itself, you'll find that although the cultural battles mutate and take different shapes and different forms, nevertheless, that's really what they were partly all about, and that motivated people, that kind of inspired people, and it also left us with a very uncomfortable legacy that, you know, we realized that we don't really have common moral norms, we don't necessarily share the same kind of values, that in many respects, what divides us more than anything is our attitude towards our personal life, towards marriage, the way we behave towards each other at a very fundamental cultural level.
Well, you mentioned the poet Edward Thomas, with whom I'm not familiar, writing a poem that I think finishes talking about Britain. She is good and must endure, loving her so, as we love ourselves, we hate her foe. It's extraordinary, the concept that we would have today, poets putting together poems of hate, as some describe them, and historians happily showing the error of the other side and the righteousness of their own side. We seem to perhaps, have we lost love of country? Is that what's happened to us?
Well, I think we've lost the capacity to have strong views and strong feelings. You know, that's what I see as a very big difference between the 21st century and the early 20th century, that regardless of what your views are, people's sentiments about the big issues of the day are held very feebly. And when you look at someone like Edward Thomas, for him, love and hate are integral to one another, as they are in real life. As we all know, you know, love always contains within the possibility of being betrayed. There's always an element of hate contained in the act of love that unfortunately occasionally is crystallized. And what Thomas was really kind of feeling was this very powerful sense of not just an intellectual or artistic, but also emotional attachment with something that was much bigger than them. And I think what's happened in the 21st century is that sadly we only feel strongly about ourselves and, you know, our lifestyles and our own behaviors and things that are really micro issues to do with parenting or with relationships. That's what we feel very strongly about. But we do not really have powerful views about the big issues of the day that affects all of us. And that has really, to some extent, indicates how the world has changed in the last over 100 years.
You do mention some more current examples and refer to the enthusiasm of some intellectuals calling for a military strike against the Serbs back in the 90s. Quoting Salman Rushdie as saying, "I've never been to Sarajevo, but I feel that I belong to it in a way." And you go on and point out about other intellectuals from the West who played significant roles in convincing the then French President Sarkozy to intervene in Libya in 2011. So the intellectuals are still there and still a part of it.
They're very much there and they're part of it, but in a very different way, because someone like Salman Rushdie doesn't volunteer to go up and fight in the front. And many of the intellectuals that called for airstrikes on Libya are basically saying, you know, push a button and strike a missile at them, you know, while we watch from Paris on 24-hour television.
And comment.
And comment on it. I think there's a very big difference because in many respects, what you have is a much more irresponsible role where intellectuals are always in the forefront of demanding intervention in Russia or interventions in Libya or interventions in Syria, everywhere in the world, for which they have no responsibility. It's not something that they've assumed as part of their persona. It's something that they outsource to other people. And I think in that sense, there's a kind of morally inferior quality to their action to the intellectuals that were around in 1914.
And do words like mission creep convey a consciousness about the dollars we spend, or do they convey something that I think might be a little bit more sinister, and that is an unwillingness to face up to being the ones responsible, perhaps, for having to go to war? As I say, no one I know imagines it's ever a good idea, but it is sometimes the better pathway. And we now want to talk about almost as if our armies are there as humanitarian social workers.
Yeah, I think you raise a very interesting point. I was talking the other day to my son, and I was trying to explain to him the importance of the concept of duty. And I realized that as I was saying that the word duty has become a totally sort of eccentric, marginal concept. People think of duty as something you pay for, and it's something that's entirely a negative phenomenon. And the idea that you and I have a duty to stand up and be counted in certain circumstances, regardless of whether we like it or not, and that we have a duty towards the elderly, towards the rest of society, has acquired an entirely rhetorical quality. So as a result of that, wars are regarded as something that other people are involved in faraway places, for as short a period of time as possible, to be conducted in the most risk-averse kind of a way. And, you know, we don't really see or care what actually happens on the ground. We just want the mission to end as fast as possible so that we don't spend too much of taxpayers' money on it. And I think that's a slightly sort of confused, disoriented way of dealing with the problems of the world.
A sense of duty. That might be what we lack. A love of country and a sense of duty. Frank, I found this a fascinating article. I thank you for joining us today, and I hope we can talk a third time, maybe more. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Frank Ferrady is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent, and his book, First World War, Still No End in Sight, has just been published by Bloomsbury. Well, that's it for this week. And as you know, abc.net.au/rn, follow the prompts to Counterpoint. That's all you need to do to leave a comment, make a suggestion, hear any or all of the program again. And we're going to end today with British composer Vaughan Williams, who interrupted his work as a composer to enlist in the medical corps. He returned from France, saddened and traumatised, and used his war experiences when he wrote his Pastoral Symphony in 1922. It is, according to the British Library, an understated and achingly beautiful monument of loss, with bugle calls echoing across the French landscape. Here's just a taste. I'm Amanda Vanstone. Until next week, arrivederci.
Twenty-odd years ago, a Danish flight attendant went on holiday to Borneo, a working holiday, in the rainforest. After 2 weeks, she saw an orangutan, and she was hooked. On her third trip, Lonna Drosher-Nielsen made a decision.
I sat down with a small group of orangutans and said, you know what, guys, I'm going to go home, I'm going to quit my job, and I'm going to come help you.
Lona Drosher-Nielsen is on Sunday Profile. Listen anytime at the RN website.